This is The Guardian.
Today, months since the Taliban took over, what is the state of Afghanistan and of the UK government's efforts to evacuate and resettle vulnerable people?
One of the strange things arriving in Taliban Afghanistan is how, in fundamental terms, everything has changed. But on the surface, it looks very unchanged.
Emma Graham-Harrison spent years as The Guardian's correspondent in Kabul as Western forces and the Afghan government fought a Taliban insurgency. She's just come back from another visit. This time, the Western forces are gone, and it's the Taliban in charge.
The streets are definitely less active than they used to be. There's, you know, because of both the economic crisis and what's going on, there's fewer women. They're dressed perhaps more conservatively than they were, but women aren't just wearing burqas.
Nearly 5 months into Taliban rule, Afghanistan is in the grip of what the UN has described as one of the worst economic meltdowns ever recorded. There are warnings people are going to start dying of hunger. Not that you could tell from parts of Kabul.
A lot of the sort of restaurants and shops have reopened. There's still the kind of fancy supermarket that was sort of where the foreigners and the elite used to go. You can sort of even buy like Dorset cereals for sort of crazy prices or M&Ms or whatever.
But scratch the surface and it's clear. Afghanistan is changing fast.
There used to be a lot of beautiful murals all over the city celebrating Afghan culture, Afghan history. And those have been painted over. Instead, they've been replaced by murals with, you know, Islamic Emirate slogans, Taliban slogans.
It's the story of two governments, one in the UK, which has been forced to defend itself against a whistleblower's claim that its handling of the withdrawal from Kabul was dysfunctional and endangered British soldiers and citizens, and of the new Afghan government, hurtling towards a humanitarian disaster. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in focus, a return to Afghanistan and to the chaotic withdrawal that left hundreds of British citizens behind. Emma, take us back to the last time you were in the region, back in August, when Afghanistan fell with shocking speed to the Taliban and Western governments rushed to evacuate their nationals and Afghans who had assisted them and their militaries over the past two decades. Remind us, what was that evacuation process like on the ground?
It was completely chaotic. I mean, I think everybody remembers the heartbreaking photos of, you know, young men falling from the wheels of planes that they desperately tried to cling to, the terrible crowds outside the airport, the heartbreaking photos of parents handing their babies to soldiers just because they thought that was the only way to save their lives, literally never knowing if they would see them again. You know, I think there was a terrible, terrible sense of fear because, you know, the last time the Taliban had come into Kabul, sort of 30 years earlier, they had tortured and murdered the former president and hung his body from a lamppost. And that set the tone for the type of brutality that you saw. And it was such a sudden military victory. Even the Taliban's commander admitted on the day they took Kabul or the day after that even they hadn't expected to be in control of the capital so quickly.
Afghanistan has new masters. 20 years after their first experiment in power came to a shattering end, the Taliban are back. Hours after arriving in Kabul, sitting at the president's desk.
The speed of it meant that all the flaws in sort of the Western approach were magnified. There seemed to be no planning, no criteria. You know, there was a mad scramble of people who had worked in Afghanistan in various different capacities, who knew people in their governments, trying to come up with lists to get the names of people they were worried about sort of onto these lists. And there was just no system. It was a sort of a scramble of kind of WhatsApp groups, really.
And Emma, we got an insight into the level of disorganisation, at least in the UK's Foreign Office in London, when a whistleblower's testimony went public this week. What did that whistleblower tell us about what was happening on the British side of things?
So, I mean, the sort of accusations that this whistleblower has made are really quite heartbreaking. You know, that thousands of emails just went unread. That, you know, at a time when speed was absolutely of the essence, you know, we knew that both that the crush around the airport was getting worse and that there was a 2-week window for evacuations, that Dominic Raab insisted on sort of more better formatted evidence before he made decisions, that there wasn't really any attempt to ramp up staffing, that staff were still working normal hours, essentially. Also, that, you know, despite the sort of human catastrophe that was unfolding, that there was a sort of personal instruction from the Prime Minister to use, quote, considerable capacity to help animals that were in a shelter run by NAWSAD, an animal rescue charity, leave Afghanistan. And, you know, of 150,000 people who applied for evacuation, fewer than 5% got any assistance. I mean, of course, not all those 150,000 people would have been eligible, but, you know, it's clear that some of those left behind have been murdered by the Taliban, you know, the whistleblower said. And I personally know of at least one case where someone's family member has been murdered.
I imagine a lot of this didn't come as a surprise to you, Emma, because like many others who used to live in Afghanistan, you were in constant contact with the Foreign Office, helping to draw their attention to ex-colleagues, to friends whose lives might be in danger. I mean, did you get a sense of the kind of chaos and indecision that this whistleblower described?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I was sort of involved with helping with applications. The Guardian, of course, was applying for our own staff members and former staff members who were at risk. And I was also speaking to people from other outlets who were, you know, trying to go through the same process for their staff members. And, you know, absolutely, there were, I think it's really important to say that there were individuals at the FCDO who absolutely went above and beyond. I mean, I guess, you know, like this whistleblower who seems to have, you know, sacrificed his career in the Foreign Office, there were people who I was speaking to who were sort of delirious with lack of sleep, who were sort of working, as far as I could see, around the clock. But the system overall, it just felt like a very faceless and inefficient, often completely incompetent machine, where you just couldn't get answers when people's lives were at risk. And, you know, some of these are just the cases that I know about. You know, one person who was approved for evacuation, we found out really months later when we finally got the Foreign Office to chase down the details, but they mistranscribed his email address. I checked that the problem was not from him or his outlet that employed him. They'd transposed an S into an F. So his email, the crucial email that you needed to take with you for evacuation, never reached him.
Okay, so that was how this whole episode started. We're now more than 4 months into Taliban rule, and the scenes of chaos at the airport that you described to us earlier are very different today. They're much more orderly. The Taliban's takeover was obviously a mammoth change for the people of Afghanistan, the majority of whom were too young to remember life when the Taliban was last in power. When you flew into Kabul, where did you start? What were you most interested in finding out about this new regime?
I suppose what I was going there to find out was, you know, personally, I'm particularly interested in what's happening with women's rights. There's a sort of question which I guess you could say arches over all the others, which is who's in control of the Taliban? They had very little experience managing a country, and suddenly they're having to do that. You know, they're having to pivot from doing sort of guerrilla military attacks to the complicated and quite boring business of running a country.
Well, let's talk about running that country, because the Afghanistan of today is one that is in deep economic crisis. And we heard from the beginning of their rule that the Taliban had a pretty difficult job ahead of them trying to improve this economy. Let's begin with why it's in such a dire state. I mean, what is it about Afghanistan that means it is now in such a deep recession?
Well, I think when we're looking at the mess that Afghanistan's in today, obviously it's important that the Taliban are held responsible for their part in it. But I think we do need to look further back as well. The government that the West supported was one that was entirely dependent on foreign aid. We supported a government and a military that had no ability to financially support itself. And while it was, of course, absolutely positive that we were putting money into things like the healthcare system and the education system, it was problematic that the Western mission was not more successful in economic development and that terrible, terrible corruption flourished. And so essentially when the Taliban took over, of course, the Western governments, the international organizations that have been supporting the previous government halted that support.
The Biden administration has already frozen $9 billion in assets.
And that was just a huge, huge part of the economy. And so essentially kind of life support to the Afghan economy was cut off. You know, whole organizations stopped working. So salaries disappeared. The money that paid teachers' salaries, that paid doctors, that dried up. And then compounding the problem, the government and individuals can't access that. There's a limit of, I think, $200 a week that you can draw out. You have people who've never needed help in, you know, their entire life. I went to one food distribution point and I met a guy who had joined the police academy when Afghanistan was still a monarchy. So over four decades ago, he was in his 70s and his son had become a prosecutor at the Attorney General's office. So when the Taliban took over, his military pension, his government pension dried up, his son's job vanished, and suddenly the family had absolutely no income. And he said, you know, I can't believe I'm at this stage in my life and I'm having to, you know, I'm very grateful, but I'm here collecting a bag of rice and some lentils and a bit of cooking oil. And this is what my family are reduced to. We've been eating once a day, if we're lucky. We've been taking old dried bread and soaking it in water and eating that. And, you know, there's families that don't even have that.
And Emma, it seems like the most serious consequences of this economic crisis you've been telling us about is the very real risk that Afghanistan might experience a famine over the next winter months. Are we already seeing evidence that that is beginning to happen?
The situation now is urgent and absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, you have 23 million people who are at risk of going hungry.
It is as bad as you possibly can imagine. In fact, we're now looking at the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. 95% of the people don't have enough food. The winter months are coming. We're coming out of a drought. The next 6 months are going to be catastrophic.
So when you talk about a famine, basically, the UN has, you need to sort of meet three criteria for a famine to be officially declared. And the first is that a certain proportion of the adult population have to not be getting enough food. A certain proportion of kids need to be severely malnourished. And then the third criteria is the sort of most tragic, and that's people have to start dying at a certain rate from starvation or from illnesses related to malnutrition. And the third step is the only one that Afghanistan hasn't yet reached. It's such a tragic situation. It's almost like all that Afghanistan is waiting for an official famine to be declared is literally for people to start dying.
Emma, earlier you said that the fancy supermarkets, the places where you could buy, you know, Dorset cereal and M&Ms, they're still stocked. So how can a country have that kind of stuff on supermarket shelves but still have people on the very verge of dying of hunger?
I mean, I'm afraid to say that is always the case with famines. There's always people who will be well fed through a famine. And I mean, indeed, I think it's important to remember that famines are not about absolute shortages of food. Usually they're about distribution of food. It's particularly serious in rural areas because a lot of Afghanistan still has very weak travel infrastructure. There's large parts of it that are mountainous, there's heavy snowfalls, and those towns and villages will be cut off for months. You know, I spoke to the head of the World Food Programme in Afghanistan while I was there, and, you know, one of the things she's appealing for most urgently is for the help, the funds to come now.
People I have met, particularly the women are not eating for days so that they can feed their children. I have met men here in Kabul who are basically scavenging in bins and at the markets to be able to bring home dry bread to their children. Or they're selling their household goods.
You know, logistically, if you think about food to feed 23 million people, that's a lot of food. You can't just sort of conjure it up overnight. You need to sort of set up massive transport infrastructure to get it into the country, and then most urgently to get it out to these rural areas before they are cut off by the snow for months at a time.
That is hugely concerning. But one of the other things you said you really wanted to know was how women were faring in this society that was suddenly an extremely restrictive theocracy. How did you find that life had changed for them?
So the Taliban have brought in a de facto ban on secondary education for girls. There are places where girls have managed to go back to school, but in the majority of the country, girls aged between 11 and 18 have no right to an education. Most women have been told that they cannot work, apart from women in healthcare and education. There's absolutely nowhere else in the world where you have these kind of sweeping controls on women's lives. From Afghan women themselves, there was some glimmer of light or glimmer of hope in their incredible courage in sort of resisting and trying to fight for their rights. And I particularly went to meet women who had fought for their schools to be reopened. So I was also reporting on the situation in the healthcare sector, which is, you know, also really stretched to a terrifying point. And I met this wonderful woman called Shirin who worked as a cleaner on the maternity ward in a hospital in Goreshk district in Helmand.
Is this the new baby?
Yes, this is the new one.
Her husband had been hit by a bomb. He was in a bus. He was a civilian and has lost his legs about 3 years previously. When she lost her salary after the Taliban took over, they were not able to afford to pay their rent. They had to leave their home. She said she couldn't afford to buy enough food for him and he died. She was left a single mother to four children. And throughout all this, she still kept coming into work because, you know, she said to me, you know, the babies still keep coming. The mothers, you know, we want the mothers to be able to give birth safely. So even when, you know, the hospital had run out of money, they didn't have any diesel to run their operating theatre. They didn't even have gloves for the midwives to keep themselves and the mothers safe. The midwives, who could hardly feed themselves, told me that they were spending their own money buying gloves to keep the mothers safe. It was a very... The courage and commitment from women living with this really terrible new reality was incredibly inspiring.
Emma, you talked about the fact that the Taliban used to be this decentralized group and are now faced with the challenge of actually running a central government. Has the Taliban been able to transform into a government? Do you get any sense of whether they're succeeding in making that transition from a militia to a governing party?
I mean, the Taliban have always been very clear. You know, they ruled the country before, they want to rule it again. For instance, I met the Kandahar chief of the Ministry for Preventing Vice, Promoting Virtue, kind of the Taliban's morality police. They were extremely feared in the last government. And he gave me this fascinating handbook that sort of detailed how they planned to kind of govern daily life in a way, you know, morality as in sort of life as it's lived. And the Taliban controlled bits of Afghanistan where they had whole shadow infrastructures of education, of health, of things like that. So they certainly were more than just a militia group, but they don't have many technocrats, bureaucrats. You know, the middle classes have fled, or a lot of the middle classes have fled the country. It's interesting that the Taliban have asked people not to leave. They've asked them to come back because I think they're very aware of the expertise that they're lacking. There's also a problem that the Taliban, there's a lot of internal divisions. I mean, they're quite an opaque organization. It's quite hard to tell what's going on, but there were some pretty credible reports that two of their most senior figures got into a physical fight in the Arg, the presidential palace in Kabul, they are, as one person said to me, a sort of emirate without an emir. Their supreme leader is basically absent. And I think one of the issues probably for the leadership, I mean, I have no, it's very hard to know what's going on inside exactly, but it's clear that you do see defections from more extreme Taliban to Islamic State, which is gathering power in Afghanistan. And so, you know, the more extremist Taliban have an argument that, you know, if you moderate on women's rights, if you moderate on these other issues, you know, we're going to have defections to Islamic State. You know, the more moderate Taliban have an argument, well, you know, if you don't let girls go to school, we're never going to get funding from the international community. So you have clearly a lot of tension internally about, you know, what exactly the Islamic Emirate, you know, the Taliban have been fighting for this Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan. What should it look like, and who exactly gets to run it?
Coming up, after more than 4 months, the British citizens who are caught in Kabul and still trying to get home. Earlier this year, we spoke to a Glaswegian man stuck in Kabul. We called him Ahmed for his safety, but now he can use his real name, Jan Ahmedzai. Jan had gone back to Afghanistan in August for the birth of his son. His wife and kids lived there. Jan had fled the Taliban once before, and when they took over again, he was one of the hundreds of British citizens who applied to be evacuated, along with his family.
It was very difficult the minute I seen the airport. It was like heavy crowd.
But it didn't happen. They joined those crowds around the airport, day after day, but couldn't find a British official to process their documents. They were there the day an Islamic State suicide bomb went off in those crowds.
5 minutes after and that blast happened, everybody was just running here and there, but thanks God we were just safe at that point. Like, the distance between me and the bomb blast were just like not very far, but I was just away from the heavy crowd.
We've been keeping up with Jan these past few months. Incredibly, he says the Foreign Office never got in touch to help him after he and his family escaped that Islamic State bombing at the Kabul airport. The evacuation flights were finished, and Jan's promise of a visa for his family to get back to the UK had expired.
I just registered myself with the FCDO. They updated their website on gov.uk just to register your presence. I'd done that a few times, but I never heard from FCDO at all. They should have been calling us.
So he and his family laid low in Kabul, found somewhere to stay, tried to make sure that if the Taliban went looking, they wouldn't know where to find him.
When I used to go to market, I used to leave my phone in the house just in case the Taliban are going to see all the emails and videos I've captured during that time. Taliban just start stopping and searching on every checkpoint.
Jan gave up hope of the UK government getting a visa for his wife and kids, who were Afghan citizens, to get out. So they ran, the whole family, across the border to Pakistan, hoping the British High Commission there would help them.
We crossed the border through the mountains. So it was a tough journey throughout, because we were carrying children and all the kids. And my oldest one is just like 12 years old, and the youngest one was just like a month and a half old. So it was just a long journey on the feet through the mountain.
So far, he's had no luck. The message from the British High Commission in Islamabad is that Jan is in Pakistan illegally, so they can't help him.
The current situation here in Pakistan is just as useless as we were in Afghanistan, because I've called a few times to British High Commission. It's like an automated service. It just keeps telling you to press this button, but there's no any other option apart from the counselor, which we need. They just hear your story, but they can't advise you any further. I can't tell like what is our future going to be like. At the moment, I'm just stuck. I've been abroad. I've been out of the country from the UK on the 3rd of August, and I'm still here.
Back in August, Jan was just a few metres from a plane that could have taken him and his family to safety. Now they're in Pakistan, waiting for help, and don't see a way out.
No school, no nothing, no life for tomorrow, so they are stuck with me here as well. So I'm just really worried, and my wife is really worried. about their future and the current situation here. And nobody knows what's going to happen. We are just like in the same place, like detainees, like living in a camp or something like this with no documents. So it's really heartbreaking when I see the kids.
Emma, we've just heard from Jan Ahmedzai, who is one of at least dozens of British citizens who never managed to get out of the region when Kabul fell. We started this by talking about the chaotic response of the UK government. Nearly 5 months later, the Foreign Office doesn't have the excuse that it's been caught by surprise anymore. Is Jan's case an exception? Has the UK managed to get its evacuation and resettlement programs into shape and get everyone out who's in danger?
No. Absolutely not. I mean, if anything, it's been as if the last couple of months, with the pressure slightly off, the government has sort of let things get even more complicated. There's people who don't know what their status is. You know, the government promised, in addition to the ARAP program, which was under which most people were given right to evacuation, the government also promised that to open up a separate refugee path to the UK to, I think, 20,000 people. And, you know, it admitted last week it hasn't even designed that system. Like, you can't even apply for that system, let alone goodness knows how long it will take to process anybody's applications. So, no, I mean, the sort of chaos and complacency of those early days seems to have just been replaced by complacency and lack of interest. The same lack of interest, I'd say, that you seem to see from, you know, engagement over the sort of, you know, risk of famine over the humanitarian crisis. You know, it just feels to me very strongly like Western governments were humiliated in Afghanistan and they really just want to walk away.
And for those people who haven't been able to make it out, I mean, we've heard from Jan, one of the examples we've talked about, but what about the others, the people who are still stuck there? What are you hearing about their fate?
It varies. I mean, it's certainly true. You know, I think we have to acknowledge that the Taliban have not been as brutal as the worst initial fears. But there's documented cases, many documented cases of reprisal killings, of forced displacement, people being pushed out of their homes from Dikundi in central Afghanistan to Kandahar in the south. You know, we have women who, being caught up in the bans on education and work, perhaps are no longer able to feed their families, to feed themselves. There are people who, millions of people who, because of the economic collapse, are not able to eat, are not able to feed their children, and are at serious risk of dying of hunger.
The Taliban's victory presented a dilemma for the international community that had seen them as a terrorist group, basically, up until the moment they became the government. But whether we like it or not, they're the people now governing this country of tens of millions of vulnerable people. How have foreign governments approached some of these issues you've been telling us about, starting with hunger and this really dire risk of famine?
The problem is, you know, Afghanistan is in a crisis. And most of our governments, you know, it's a time of great strain, kind of with the pandemic and economically. And it feels like a lot of people in Western governments just want to walk away from Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban are sort of so abhorrent in so many of the things they're doing, you know, particularly their treatment of women. We've had reports of awful reprisal killings. You know, it's very easy to say these guys are just terrorists and walk away. But the problem is that if you do that, it's not really the Taliban who are going to pay the price. I mean, when I was in Kabul, I went to meet a Taliban official. It was off record, so I can't say who, but relatively senior. And he said to me, like all the officials I met, you know, you need to unfreeze our funds. You know, we need our money back so we can run the country. And if you don't, I'm not going to be the one who's suffering. I'm going to have enough money to keep my office warm. The winter's very cold in Afghanistan. I'm going to have enough money for my food. My salary is going to be paid. It's not going to be me who suffers. And, you know, it was a pretty blunt way of putting it, but it's the truth.
The last time we spoke to you, Emma, you said that people in Afghanistan, especially women, had experienced education, they'd had the taste of a freer life, and that the Taliban no matter how much they tried, wouldn't be able to erase that, and that that gave you some sense of hope that the future of Afghanistan would not be like the past. And I wonder, having spent a bit more time there now, after months of Taliban rule, if you still feel that same hope.
Well, it's interesting you asked that, Mike, because I was actually talking last night to some Afghan women, journalists, and a businesswoman, someone who works in the medical sector, and they were saying exactly that. Despite their fears, despite their worries, they said, you know, it isn't the same country it was when the Taliban came to power in the 1990s, and Afghan women are not the same. We've been educated. And I think you see, you know, the fact that girls are still in primary school, I think, is a reflection. You know, it's the Taliban acknowledging that the country has changed, perhaps that the Taliban themselves have changed. And I think you've seen that, you know, in the struggle over the last couple of months, both for women's rights, these protests where you've seen women coming out literally risking their lives to ask for their rights to work and to study. So, yes, I think those 20 years have changed Afghanistan and has created, you know, an incredible generation of Afghan women who are going to continue fighting for their rights, and who will, you know, perhaps not on the battlefield, but who will prove to be formidable opponents for the Taliban in the years that come.
Emma Graham-Harrison, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
That was Emma Graham-Harrison, a senior international correspondent with The Guardian. You can read all her latest pieces from Afghanistan at theguardian.com. Thanks very much to her, and also to Jan Ahmadzai, who spoke to us from Pakistan, and we'll keep you updated on his case. A UK government spokesperson said staff, including 1,000 people from the FCDO, quote, worked tirelessly to evacuate more than 15,000 people from Afghanistan within a fortnight, in the biggest mission of its kind in generations and the second largest evacuation carried out by any country. They added, the scale of the evacuation and the challenging circumstances meant decisions on prioritisation had to be made quickly to ensure we could help as many people as possible. Regrettably, they said, we were not able to evacuate all those we wanted to, but since the end of the operation, we have helped more than 3,000 individuals leave Afghanistan. And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atak and Eva Krizyak. Sound design is by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Mythili Rao. Back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.